Hello, this is Dave with the News Gazette for Sunday, May 25th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined Memorial Day Weekend. On a lonely road in 1944 France, a German machine gunner ended a Gifford kid's life. This is by Dave Hinton, Rantoul. Larry Wallace is interested in family history, and while touring Holy Sepulchre Cemetery in Rantoul, where many family members are buried, he came across the headstone of one of the casualties of World War II. Sergeant Joseph R. Quinlan of rural Gifford was killed near Saint-Lô, France, just 20 days after the Allies landed on the beaches at Normandy as part of the D-Day invasion to take Europe back from Nazi Germany. As I stood there and pondered this sad sight, I thought of the sacrifice Joseph had given to our country and the pain of his parents, Wallace wrote in a history researching Sergeant Quinlan's death. Joe Bolser of Rantoul, Sergeant Quinlan's nephew, supplied Wallace with much of the information inside. Bolser has his uncle's Purple Heart. It means a great deal to him, reminding him of his sacrifice. Our family was extremely tight, said Bolser, who was given the Purple Heart as well as a great deal of paperwork from his grandparents, Sergeant Quinlan's parents. Much of the paperwork includes letters from one of Sergeant Quinlan's brothers, Charles Quinlan Jr., writing to his parents from overseas, where he too was fighting the Nazis. Bolser also has a Western Union telegram sent by Charles Quinlan, informing his parents that Sergeant Quinlan's remains would be sent to Rantoul for reburial. Charles had enlisted in the Army in 1941, prior to the U.S. entering the war, and was a lieutenant in 1944, at the time of his brother's death, also serving in France. A sergeant by the name of Norbert had been with Joe since Camp Maxey, Wallace wrote, quoting information supplied by Charles Quinlan. Sergeant Norbert recognized Joe's talents. He was able to get Joe out of the radio MOS, which he had originally been trained for, and had a hand in his promotion to sergeant, Wallace wrote. He also recognized Sergeant Quinlan's leadership ability. Sergeant Quinlan was placed in command of his own unit that included an M8 Greyhound, that's an armored car used for reconnaissance, and a couple of Jeeps. He was on the road between St. Laurent and St. Lô, out front with a mine detector when he was killed by machine gun fire. He was 20 years old. Raised on the family farm near Gifford, Sergeant Quinlan was a Rantoul High School graduate. He initially worked at Caterpillar in Peoria and for the U.S. Post Office in Rantoul prior to being drafted into the military. He was the sixth and youngest child of Charles and Catherine Cody Quinlan. After training in the United States, Sergeant Quinlan sailed for Scotland November 15, 1943, arriving 5 days later. It was there at Exeter at Topsham Barracks that Sergeant Quinlan trained for the invasion of France, which would take place June 6, 1944. While fighting on the beaches was brutal, so was the combat inland. Numerous hedgerows made it a cat-and-mouse game. It was in that area that Sergeant Quinlan died. He was originally buried in the military cemetery at St. Laurent before his parents, Charles A. and Catherine E. Quinlan, asked that his remains be brought to Rantoul for reburial. By special recognition of Mayor Ralph Scott, All Rantoul businesses were asked to close at 9 a.m. the day of the funeral services, and all American flags in Rantoul were flown at half mast. Sergeant Quinlan was the first victim of overseas action to be buried in Rantoul. Services were held at St. Malachy Catholic Church. And continuing on the front page, we have My Turn, Larry D. Boone, Leading While Black and Blue. Urbana's police chief reflects on leading a large law enforcement division and holding a Black Lives Matter sign in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder 5 years ago. With Sunday marking the five-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder, I find myself reflecting deeply on the profound impact the event had on me, both personally and professionally. On the evening of May 28, 2020, as the ashes of unrest burned in Minneapolis, with the police department's third precinct engulfed in flames, a somber realization settled across the country. Demonstrations over George Floyd's tragic death had sparked a wave of protests that were both deeply emotional and highly charged. In Norfolk, Virginia, where the streets were filled with voices demanding justice but remained largely peaceful, the tension was palpable. By May 29th, the Norfolk Police Department had received troubling intelligence indicating that the first patrol precinct was targeted for destruction the following day. With the recent violence in Minneapolis in mind, there was a clear and present concern for the safety of officers and professional staff at the precinct. The plan was straightforward: to monitor the situation closely and prepare for any eventuality. On May 30th, as reports filtered in that several hundred protesters had gathered at the precinct, my usual role of observing from a distance took on a more immediate urgency. I arrived at the precinct to find a sea of faces. The magnitude of the gathering was quite alarming. As I parked my vehicle, the thought of deploying the crowd management team was a looming possibility, but their presence felt like a last resort. I needed to understand the crowd and the threat level more intimately. For a brief moment, it looked like the protesters were leaving, moving toward the nearby university. I was somewhat relieved and thought we might have just dodged a bad situation. But that calm was short-lived. I heard over the radio that the crowd was returning, now bigger and more resolute. One of the officers reported they'd heard the group was planning to storm the precinct this time. At this moment, I faced a critical choice. The order came through to deploy the crowd management team, and I knew that such a move could provoke further unrest. I envisioned the potential clash and chaos that could ensue and decided to take a different path. Besides, we were severely outnumbered. Trusting the social capital we had built over years of engagement with the community, I left my vehicle and positioned myself in front of the precinct. The crowd surged around me rather quickly, their anger palpable, their voices roaring with frustration. Surprisingly, fear didn't come over me. Instead, I searched the sea of faces, hoping to find someone familiar. Then, among the sea of people, I spotted a young man with a bullhorn. I approached him, requested the bullhorn, and began to speak. "Your voices have been heard," I said. "We understand your grievances, and I know these are difficult times." I then made an attempt to find middle ground between the community's frustration and the police position by saying, "However, you cannot blame an entire profession for the acts of one individual. Most police are good people merely trying to do a difficult job during a very difficult time. March with us, march with us. The remarks were met with visible frustration and only seemed to escalate tensions. Members of the crowd responded with angry shouts, some using profanity and expressing that they were unwilling to accept what they saw as empty or dismissive statements. I then spoke from the heart, trying to connect with the crowd by acknowledging their pain and frustration. I said, "What happened to George Floyd was wrong. I stand with you in the belief that justice must and will be served." In that moment, I felt a subtle shift, a sense that, for the first time, I was beginning to connect with them on a deeper level. I could tell they hadn't expected to hear those words from me. As I continued discussing various topics of police reform, their tone began to change. Eventually, they started chanting, their voices rising in unison, "March with us, march with us." It was a demand that would test the boundaries of my role as police chief and the trust I was trying to build in that moment between us. With each chant, I could feel the tension rising, so I made the decision to step into the heart of the crowd. There, they began asking me a barrage of questions about police brutality and the need for police reform. The engagement stretched on, lasting what felt like hours, as I fielded every question, honestly. Again, I felt a sense of relief, as I knew marching with them would have caused significant problems with the rank and file and would not be viewed positively by some. However, that brief sense of relief was short-lived as the crowd's chants quickly resumed, this time more demanding, "March with us, march with us." But then, in a pivotal moment, the chants went silent. A young man stepped forward, holding a Black Lives Matter sign, and said, "Chief, back your words up by holding this sign." I understood that holding the sign was about more than just symbolism. It carried potential career repercussions and could deeply divide the department. Some officers viewed Black Lives Matter as a critique of law enforcement, and my decision could be seen as political, divisive, or even an acknowledgement of systemic failures. Such an act could fuel mistrust, lower morale, and foster resistance to my leadership. But refusing it risked escalating the situation to a point of possible violence and destruction. The young man in the blue shirt presented the sign. He seemed surprised that I held it. The sign bore the names of those who had become symbols of the call for police reform and justice. Among them was the name of an individual who had been armed with a gun and was involved in an officer-involved shooting with one of my officers, an officer I had publicly supported just weeks earlier. I knew that holding the sign would be seen as a gesture of solidarity by some in the community, but also seen by some as a betrayal of the police force I represented. However, to me, the sign simply meant Black Lives Matter too. It was a call for recognition, dignity, and justice, an affirmation that Black lives deserve the same value and protection as any other. I never imagined that such a straightforward expression of humanity would be misinterpreted by some as suggesting that other lives don't matter. That idea is completely absurd. In a moment of deep reflection, I was overcome with inner conflict. I've had the privilege of working alongside some outstanding officers of all races, dedicated professionals who serve with honor and integrity. Yet the hard truth is that law enforcement has not always treated minority communities, particularly the Black community, with fairness or respect. I haven't been immune to profiling. beyond everything else, I couldn't ignore my own painful memories. One incident that still haunts me happened when I was in middle school. I was big for my age, and that seemed to make me a target. The police stopped me, saying I, quote, fit the description, unquote. Once they realized I wasn't the suspect, there was no apology, just a racial slur and a kick to my backside. I was so terrified and humiliated in that moment that I lost control and urinated on myself. Even as a police chief, I haven't been immune to profiling. The weight of those experiences is something I carry with me and are impossible to set aside. Despite that history, I still found myself torn, caught between my duty to the badge and my commonality with a community shaped, like me, by lived experiences of injustice. It was a deeply personal struggle. But in that tension, I also felt a responsibility to lead, to advocate for meaningful reform, and to help rebuild the trust that has been broken. So, I took a deep breath and lifted the Black Lives Matter sign. The crowd fell into a heavy silence, so dense, it felt as if you could slice through it. In that stillness, time seemed to stand still. That day, the protests ended without violence. No one was hurt, nothing was destroyed, but the calm on the streets didn't reflect the storm that followed. The incident caught fire, spreading from local to national news and beyond. Praise came swiftly from the Black community, grassroots organizations, local universities, and a range of local and state officials, including the governor and even the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. But over time, a wave of resignations swept through the police department, not just in Norfolk, but across the nation. While I firmly believed police reform was necessary, I also saw how some measures overreached. As the pressures grew, the early praise and public support I had once received began to wane. A few stood by me, though mostly in quiet ways, a message here, a nod there, gestures that spoke louder than words. Meanwhile, the voices of opposition grew louder, more persistent, and harder to ignore. Their outrage seemed to drown out the softer voices of solidarity. Additionally, I watched as individuals and even some police organizations that had once praised my leadership began to distance themselves. It was a day marked by intense choices, and my actions that day would be remembered as a complex and significant chapter in the ongoing dialogue about justice and police community relations. The attached photos from that day capture a pivotal moment and spoke volumes. Amidst a sea of protesters, these images reflected a complex interplay of vulnerability and hope. As my college coach used to say, do right. Throughout the summer of 2020, protests in Norfolk remained peaceful, even as some neighboring cities faced looting, arson, and widespread property damage. Norfolk's ability to maintain calm during such a volatile national moment was a testament to both the women and men of the Norfolk Police Department. I retired from Norfolk in May 2022. After a brief break, I started interviewing for police chief jobs. I was a finalist in every job I applied to. As expected, in almost every interview, the Black Lives Matter march surfaced, sometimes directly, other times more subtly. As a Black police chief, I recognize that white chiefs may face similar challenges as well. Black police chiefs carry a profound and often heavy burden. There's an unspoken expectation that they will stand for the Black community, reflect its pain, hopes, and demands for justice, even as they serve within a system that has long struggled with that very community. At the same time, they're called to push for change from within, guided by the weight of their own lived experiences. There is often hesitation in addressing racial issues, driven by the fear of losing support or position within the force. Speaking out can feel like walking a tightrope. While we know systemic issues within law enforcement must be confronted, doing so can be perceived as undermining the institution itself. Pushing for change might create division and alienate those who see such conversations as disruptive. Yet, as leaders, we have an obligation to represent the communities we serve and the officers we lead. This is a responsibility that demands courage, especially when navigating an institution historically slow to address these critical concerns. Ultimately, we must summon the integrity to lead, even when it feels uncomfortable, and ensure that progress is prioritized over comfort, even at our own peril. I'm often asked whether, given the chance, I would make the same decisions again. My answer is always yes. I've never led for popularity. I've led to do what's right. Throughout every challenge, I've remained grounded in a principle I first learned from my college football coach, Eric Russell, the legendary head coach at Georgia Southern University. Coach Russell instilled in us a simple yet profound mantra: do right. It wasn't just a slogan. It was a way of life, a call to integrity, accountability, and ethical conduct. It meant making the honorable choice, taking responsibility, and always striving to contribute something positive to the world around us. Do right became more than a team motto. It became the foundation of our identity and, for me, a lasting moral compass. It continues to guide how I lead, how I serve, and how I live. Larry D. Boone is chief of the Urbana Police Department. Continuing inside the front page, at top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rossow. At 65, with bachelor's and master's degrees from Eastern Illinois University, Champaign's Amy Myers is back in college. She pays tuition to play trumpet alongside a much younger crowd in Chip McNeil's impressive concert jazz band at the University of Illinois. Yep, she loves music that much. "I'm the band mom," she said. "Seriously, these guys play real grown-up music. It's the hardest music that I've played in my life, but also the most fun." Retired after a long run teaching economics at EIU and Parkland College, her days are filled with family, husband, two daughters, four grandchildren, and music. That includes performing taps at Philo American Legion Post 1171. Memorial Day services on Monday. She's been teaming with Chad Billman for almost a decade. Their renditions of Echo Taps setting the mood every time. "Emotional and sentimental," said Myers, whose dad, Raymond Myers of Centralia, served in World War II. "I always think of how proud he would be every time I play taps. It's such an honor." And in history, area history, in 1925, countywide damage to crops of all kinds and setbacks to fruits and vegetables as a result of the sharpest temperature drop recorded locally in more than 25 years for the month of May was reported by the Champaign County Farm Bureau. In 1975, the Champaign Library Board accepted the unrestricted donation of the Champaign Asphalt Company building at 310 East Bradley Avenue to provide a branch library for Northside residents. The board president said one option is to sell the property and use the money to build at a more suitable location on the north side. In 2010, the University of Illinois pledges to stop using coal within 7 years as part of a plan to reduce energy use and cut carbon emissions. In international history, today's highlight: on May 24th, 2022, an 18-year-old gunman, opened fire at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, killing 19 children and two teachers. The gunman, Salvador Ramos, a former student at the school, was also killed. It was the deadliest shooting at a U.S. elementary school since the 2012 attack on Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. On this date, in 1844, Samuel F.B. Morse transmitted the message, "What hath God wrought?" from Washington to Baltimore as he formally opened America's first telegraph line. In 1883, New York's Brooklyn Bridge, at the time the world's longest suspension bridge, opened to traffic. And in community news, Champaign County Board, District 10 Dem quits to join Sanitary District by Jana Wiersema, Urbana. Champaign County Board member Chris Storr has announced his resignation, effective immediately. County Executive Steve Summers said Storr, a Democrat who represents District 10, is joining the Urbana-Champaign Sanitary District Board and cannot be a part of both bodies. He added that while the county will miss Storr, this is an absolutely perfect match given his knowledge of groundwater and water treatment. It is with mixed emotions that I tender my resignation from the Champaign County Board. As of the end of this meeting, Storr said Thursday night, "I'm proud to have served with all of you, and I leave knowing that challenges remain, including the demolition of the old jail and the really old Poor Farm nursing home. I have confidence that you will find consensus among yourselves and hopefully work to achieve harmony in resolving those issues." According to county officials, Storr had been a board member since October 2017, and his current term expires November 30th, 2026. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Sunday, May 25th, 2025. Please stay tuned.